And welcome to All Over the Map, Collection Management Issues for Works in Public Places. I'm Anne-Marie Perkey-Levine, and I'll be offering some introductory contextual information on the topic. And then the panelists will take us deeper into best practices with a number of case studies. So I'm happy to introduce Jen Doyle Crane from the San Francisco Arts Commission, Kathy Lang, curator at the Jean Lafitte National Park here in New Orleans, and Rowan Geiger, director and principal conservator at SF Art Conservation. After over a decade of working in exhibition and collection management at a number of art institutions, I decided to switch gears and venture into the field of public art as a project manager for the Civic Art Collection at the San Francisco Arts Commission, and now as an independent professional consultant. My true love lies with works located beyond the white walls of the gallery. At its best, publicly cited work can offer not only an aesthetic, intellectual, and visceral experience for a wide audience, but can help identify and shape communities, and dare I use the trending phrase, act as placemakers. However, in the words of both Winston Churchill and Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. This responsibility lies with artists and makers, curators and administrators, to be sensitive to concerns regarding cultural heritage, existing community politics, physical site conditions, and of course the reason we're all here this weekend, object stewardship. Professionals who work with publicly cited works face a distinct set of challenges. We don't always have control over these conditions, but we can plan for them during the development, fabrication, and installation processes, and when developing maintenance plans. One of the large issues we deal with is vandalism and public abuse. This is a hard reality that absolutely must be accounted for when developing maintenance plans and budgets. Even temporary works, such as this Lent Space installation in Manhattan from 2009, the image on the left, can quickly become canvases for personal and political statements, or what I found to be much more common, the mindless board scrawlings of inconsiderate individuals. Partial or complete theft of an object is also an issue, as with the image on the right, a Louise Bourgeois iBenches 4, two benches that were on loan from the artist to the city of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. In 2010, the bronze corneas of the eyes were stolen as scrap metal for resale. People will steal anything if it's not bolted down, and even when it is, they will still try. I love this image of someone's grassroots efforts to recover the missing components. We also have geographical and fabrication constraints. The image on the left is a trail map of Philosopher's Way at McLaren Park in San Francisco, a wonderful installation along 3 miles of trails consisting of over 60 components comprised of granite musing stations, benches, and stone markers, and incredibly difficult to maintain due to the lack of a local water source and the need to literally hike in between each station to perform condition assessments and treatments. Fabrication and oversized scale are also often issues with public works, as with this work on the right by Cliff Garton at San Francisco General Hospital that's installed on a hilltop and has very narrow gaps between the steel beams, making it difficult to access for cleaning. And both of these projects are going to be discussed in greater detail by several of our panelists. Environmental conditions. On the left, we have this striking image of downtown New Orleans after Katrina, a sculpture from the World's Fair. And on the right is Night Presence 4 by Louise Nevelson, located in Manhattan's Upper East Side. Grit, pollution, and water damage from the urban environment took its toll on the core 10 steel sculpture, and the work had to be completely deinstalled and partially refabricated by the city. And finally, lack of staffing, funding, and infrastructure support. Although I've saved this for last, it's often the root issue, which then leads to worsened damage from the prior conditions. The image on the left is the McKinley Monument in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park. It's located on park property that is managed by the Recreation and Parks Department. However, the Arts Commission is 100% responsible for its maintenance and care, and it's tagged on nearly a monthly basis. Top right, we have Nobi Nagasawa's Ship Shape Shifting Time, also located in San Francisco. This installation took nearly a decade from the time of its commission to its installation, and is now home to a large encampment and is subject to continual trash and vandalism. The bottom right, Tony DeLapp's Wave in Santa Monica. This was commissioned as part of the city's Percent for Art program in 1989, but without an adequate funding source for its maintenance, which is so often the case with Percent for Art programs. The work suffered from 20 years of rust and corrosion and an outdated and non-functioning lighting system. The city was finally able to dedicate funds for its restoration in 2011. And now I'm happy to pass this on to Jen Doyle Crane.
Thank you. Good job. Good morning. I just thought I'd give you a quick brief history of the San Francisco Civic Art Collection. Our earliest art policies date back to the establishment of the Arts Commission under a 1932 San Francisco Charter. The charter gave the Arts Commission jurisdiction over all of the art belonging to the city and charged the agency with the preservation and care of artwork in the Civic Art Collection. Years later, in 1969, the Art Enrichment Ordinance was enacted to provide a guaranteed funding source and a mechanism for the acquisition of artwork for the new public facilities and civic spaces. This ordinance was one of the first of its kind and ensured that 2% of the gross construction cost of civic buildings, transportation improvement projects, new parks, and other above-ground structures such as bridges be allocated for public art. The public art program is committed to promoting a diverse and stimulating cultural environment in order to enrich the lives of the city residents, visitors, and employees. The majority of these works are then accessioned and accepted into the Civic Art Collection. But then what? Who takes care of it? And not just who, but how to best take care of a diverse collection, a collection located all over the city with varying environmental conditions, varying city partners, stakeholders, and agencies. These types of work range from temporary installations to mitigate construction sites, redeveloping a newly burgeoning neighborhood, and monumental and architecturally integrated new works. But then remember, we're charged and have jurisdiction over all of the art belonging to the city and charged with its preservation. So this brings us back to our wonderful and inherited legacy of very distinct yet categorically different areas of our collection, all of which live in the public domain, such as WPA murals in historic sites, such as Coit Tower and the Beach Chalet, the bronze monuments of Golden Gate Park, and a large, eclectic 2D collection inherited through an annual arts festival that purchased works directly from local artisans and artists from 1946 to 1989. Needless to say, the collection is diverse, and its maintenance conservation needs vary widely in type, cost, and expertise, ranging from the examples I mentioned to newly commissioned time-based media, sound installations, video art, and the fabrication to develop and install large sculptures. These charts give you a sense of our numbers by the collection types, in addition to the type of sites and works in the Civic Art Collection. One of the biggest challenges we face has been a historically, and what is typical of a municipal collection, an underfunded, understaffed department. Just until 3 years ago, the care of the Civic Art Collection came under the care of one full-time registrar collections manager. With one project manager, 3 years ago, I came on as an associate with my position funded 50% for the care of the Civic Art Collection and 50% in the public art program. A staff of three, but really 2.5, expected to actively manage an aging collection with ongoing complex conservation projects such as Coit Tower, all of which have multiple city partners and stakeholders. In addition to my position, this year we completed the first ever rather citywide, wall-to-wall inventory of the Civic Art Collection and are able to arrive at these accurate numbers through the help of a contracted position that was added through the help of our colleagues Anne-Marie and Eleanor Sandys. So these are just some more numbers. This has given us some time to begin reshaping our department. We've come a long way from this, and this method of accessioning to developing architectural pieces. This has given us some room to begin reshaping our department. My role has been able to begin to oversee and address the proper documentation of art enrichment projects, which means not just assembling an object file at time of accession, but to instead begin at the initiation of a project, overseeing and advising on final installation plans, and transferring pertinent construction documentation to the archive to aid in future maintenance and cost projections, and to be as prepared as possible for the unanticipated. Having our hands in and our eyes on the development of an object, not just files dumped in a box, arriving to the collections department when project is complete. So I've selected three different scenarios of various projects that I've recently had my hand on. It was hard to choose from 65 current active art enrichment projects, which are all in various phases of development, construction, and fabrication schedules. The first one I chose is a streetscape project called Domestic Seating. It was done in conjunction with the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency, Public Utilities Commission, and the Department of Public Works. The streetscape improvement is at the intersection of Church and DeBow Streets, and the Arts Commission commissioned artist Primitiva Suarez-Wolf to create a series of artworks that addressed the community's request for more seating in the area adjacent to a busy intersection that was for a new transit stop. The artist, inspired by the discarded furniture commonly seen on city sidewalks, Domestic Seating invokes intimate interior spaces and unexpectedly transforms this intersection into a shared experience. The collection of seating replicated in metal, bronze, was selected by the artist through a casting call, announced to local residents. The original furniture was donated by members of the community. We joke that this installation was my initiation to the Arts Commission, my hazing into the public realm. This is the day we installed it. Maybe a couple days later, or after one of the multiple cleanings. Because I kid you not, 24 hours later, this is what it looked like. It was immediately vandalized. This piece was not just on view in the public realm, but human interaction is a huge component and intent of this artwork. But it's also one of its biggest challenges. It is not just the graffiti, various liquids, human fluids, and other unmentionable lovely happenings. But that wasn't it. This piece had immediate complaints from a concerned citizen who raised issue with the path of travel being disrupted on the sidewalk, with who, making a long story short, resulted in two of the chairs on the adjacent corner having to be moved. Regardless that this had been a well-coordinated, best-foot-forward, and multi-agency effort, the installation had, of course, been permitted, and the installation plans were reviewed by the Mayor's Office of Disability. So this meant the destruction of newly laid sidewalks, unsetting our bulletproof theft-deterrent bolts, permitting and coordinating the destruction and repouring of the cement through the Department of Public Works, disturbing the local neighborhood again, and all while safely removing chairs and reinstalling. Unanticipated, especially given our due diligence and commitment to AD accessibility and community process. But now, getting back to the vandalism, we were not so naive to think that these wouldn't be tagged, but to the extent and so immediately and completely, we did anticipate vandalism and had been actively drafting a maintenance plan with local business community, the volunteers who had been willing and had come forward suggesting that we perform routine washing, and they were concerned in making sure that they were involved in keeping the area clean and enjoying this new commission. However, the artwork had garnered so much attention, and the immediate severity of the vandalism immediately required the care of a conservator. It became apparent, and we contacted such a professional as Rowan Geiger, sitting to my left. Cleanings and coatings were discussed along with the artist and the conservator, and it became apparent that a qualified technician under the supervision of a conservator would be necessary, not a volunteer. In order to mitigate and prevent tagging, we decided a monthly schedule cleaning, for which Rowan will later discuss in more detail. But there were many challenging layers to the coordination of this project, but also the ethical challenge balancing the artist's intent and the real-world care. Both of these situations somewhat changed the artist's intent with their new placement and the original light and airy gold patina chairs immediately affected. But this artwork became our poster child for the need of the involvement of collection staff earlier in the process at a time of installation. It was one of the first projects to initiate maintenance funds being set aside before a project was closed and handed over to the Civic Art Collection. Care began right away and has been maintained on a monthly basis, mitigating and deterring such extreme vandals. It's not perfect, but it's the real world. And we have some lovely language. The second case I chose, this is an example of large-scale architectural works at our acute care center at General Hospital, which kicked off the 2% for art ordinance. The two works I'm going to mention both have issues before installation has been completed and open to the public. The first is an artwork by Cliff Garten, which Anne-Marie mentioned, Ethereal Bodies. The sculpture is formed of 8 elements, which vary in height between 13 and 17 feet and a maximum 3-foot diameter. The elements are formed polished rods. They're type 304, stainless steel, and were assured to be bulletproof. It also has LED lighting components and landscaping, which are other topics unto themselves of maintenance and questions of registration and how to track that. But the immediate, and I mean immediate, issue at hand was rust. 2 weeks after installation, we were in coordination with the studio. Technical documents and maintenance plans had already been provided and from the studio and stated a simple washing with a citric cleaner would do. The studio came out, washed it, and it looks great. However, 2 months later, environmental conditions have proven more than difficult. We are in the delicate balance of delivering the news and sleuthing what seems to be ferrous corrosion around all the welds, but are the fabrication issues? There's a serious amount of dirt. Should it have been coated before leaving the studio, and with what? And then how long does that get maintained? Another example of the importance of involving a conservator and collections minds earlier in the development process. And this is after it was recently washed and cared for. The second is Archipelago by Anna Valentina Murch. This artist has designed the entire plaza with sculptural seating, planters, and olive trees to be like islands set in a meandering river. One form flows into another to create passageways and quiet areas of solitude at the entrance to the new center. At the center of the plaza stands an internally lit sculpture like a lantern, which will serve as a beacon of light at night. Again, rust, but this time, a disgruntled site worker poured corrosive acid on elements, not just on the art elements, but elements all throughout the construction site. The goal and the struggle of these construction sites is varying to be nimble sometimes because of the reality of the situation dealing with industrial materials, construction schedules, but designating the level of expertise needed on the fly immediately and to mitigate as soon as possible. Both of these examples began their life with immediate issues and have required serious conservation before the works were even considered complete or live. Having collection specialists managing and documenting site logistics and installations, this served as a great test run on how we're going to maintain these in the future because site logistics were worked out. And it was particularly interesting when comparing the lessons learned because similar materials but totally different situations and varying conversations with different experts about what kind of coding, industrial advice versus conservation advice, and then, the reality of how things are going to be used. So these were like light posts, steel light posts on the site that somebody had done. But I can't just show you all my the problem children. I also wanted to show you that some of the interior works that are being developed. This is a terrazzo floor and accompanying large-scale mosaics inside the lobby of the building, where, of course, we have more control because they're inside and two-dimensional. This is a local artist, Jet Martinez, a local muralist, this is his first public commission translating his work into a mosaic. And Lena Wolf, another local artist. And then in the building, there's halls, connecting halls on 8 floors, and an artist was commissioned for each floor, which, again, these are also really interesting because they each provided a unique challenge on each floor, because at each installation, each artist who had been given architectural specifications, each reacted in their own way and fabricated in their own way, and the reaction to the light and the bends and down to like nuts and bolts of how they each reinforced theirs came with very different solutions, but they all worked. So finally, as some of you may know or have enjoyed, we also have a robust and world-class art program at SFO. A lot of our historic civic art collection pieces are on view there. Last year we completed Terminal 3, and I'm just going to share some overall architectural photos of how art's enjoyed in the public space. Jay DeFeo. This is a large lighted sculpture piece at the end of the terminal. But it's hard to choose two things from SFO in this. It's such a wonderful and large collection. We have so many pieces there. But I chose these two works to compare because they're good examples of interactive and live projects that provide long-term testing in the real world, active pieces. Both these pieces rely on human interaction, and the first I'm going to talk about is Eric Stoller's Spirogyrate. It consists of 12 spinning discs with touch motion sensors similar to that of your touch screen, that when you step on each circle, the glass circle, each activate the spinning of the graphic pattern below with a varying light show. It's a delightful and fun piece and was intended as a kids romping kind of area entertainment. Recently we received a call that the artwork hadn't been working for over a week and if we could send someone over. The piece has been installed a little over a year, and as we'd gone back to check in, we noticed varying degrees of particulate and dust around the edges of the piece. We knew we would be due for maintenance and a cleaning as well, and a review of the motors and the gears, and making sure everything is, you know, has that lifetime guarantee and that they're still living up to it. So we sent the fabricator out, and you may think it was almost as simple as the electrical switch housed next door, but not quite. We did check the light source, but what could it be? The electrical switch was housed right immediately to the left of the piece, but it turns out the main power supply to the piece had been tripped due to a fire alarm test. Was it a catastrophic failure? It didn't make sense, but it had been tripped due to the fire alarm, which sounds simple and kind of silly, so let's just reset it. Well, it is, but it's not. Where and how do we reset it? The notes provided to us, electrical plans only dealt with the immediate circuits and switch in the neighboring closet. We had provided all this information to the on-site team. We had provided all that was given to us. Well, not being an electrician or an engineer, I hadn't asked those questions. It didn't occur to me that the maintenance documents provided hadn't accounted for this. Well, this type of snafu requires multiple levels of on-site coordination, determining who is responsible, who can help us figure this out, locate the switch, and have access. In the end, we had the SFO engineering team, the security team, the electrical team, the contracted electrical team, and the former construction crew all digging up plans, all to find that the troubling switch was actually on the floor below us, which did indeed require access into a locked engineering room housed in a separate floor and a security team required to allow us access. Will this happen again? It may. It probably will. But now we know, and we have it documented, and where to go and who on site to call. Making relations with you and your client agencies and on-site contacts are crucial in the life of a public art piece. The other piece I was going to mention is Charles Sauer's Butterfly Wall. It's a beloved and well-known piece. The butterfly wall consists of 20 hand-cranked mechanical butterflies that are propelled up a cable to gently flutter back down again in a delightful, random, choreographed flutter. They rise up with a hand crank and then flutter down to the bottom of the case. If the cranks are not being used, there is a timed program set of movements that activate these butterflies. It's wonderfully engineered. It's on a regular maintenance schedule for dusting, but it turns out that part of the daily maintenance plan had increased in scope. The on-site registrar at SFO has had to reset each of the electrical motion sensors housed at the top edge of the belt that, when activated, allow the butterfly to flutter down to the bottom of the case. These sensors, however ingenious and well-engineered, didn't fully account for the bounce and sway of the terminal floor and our earthquake engineering of the building. These sensors, however ingenious, didn't account for the mass of the terminal, and they were knocking each other out of a very specific sensor eye just far enough out of alignment that the eye and receiver don't meet. So here it is, we're on a schedule for maintenance, it's being taken care of, we all have the specifications, the registrar is able to figure it out, provide a solution, but is this tenable and realistic for the long term? No, it's annoying. Time consuming, and in just 3 years the technology and price have changed for the motion sensors, and new sensors with a larger eye and receiver will replace the current motors. Here we are with a simple solution, but to make this fix begins with a conversation and communication between the departments, a budget, navigating city processes, and to contract the right person to make the fix. So these are a number of stories. I'm sure many of you can relate. And part of our fun of our job and our careers is sleuthing and providing solutions to the day-to-day and helping artists ultimately realize their vision without sacrificing their vision. But and I have other pictures of other things that went well. We have a new mosaic by Amy Ellingson, beautiful glass piece by Val Britton. So you may ask, how do you and how are you working to meet this challenge? I just can't stress the importance of the team approach and qualified colleagues and taking the collections mindset back to the beginning of these projects, relying on your colleagues and asking the questions. As soon as artwork opportunities are identified, initial reviewing of space with environmental conditions, the review of the artist proposals, creating reports and tracking fields and databases for easier reporting. It sounds easy and part of what we're all trained to do, but involving conservators and expert technicians earlier to advise, anticipate, propose, and initiate maintenance plans. Assessing and aggregate development and installation processes by lessons learned, materials used, and to share that with our colleagues. Educating about best practices and providing tools within our agency, our city counterparts, and public art project managers. And to be proactive and flexible, and always retain your sense of humor. So I hope you've enjoyed hearing some of my make it work moments, and I'm going to pass it along to some others.
All right, can you hear me? I talk softly, so it's important to have a microphone. I work at Jean Lafitte National Historical Park and Preserve. We have six sites in our park. We have the French Quarter Visitor Center, the Barataria Preserve, the Chalmette Battlefield, and three Acadian cultural sites. Today I'm going to talk about Chalmette Battlefield for a couple of reasons. Number one, does that work? Oh, okay. The reason I'm choosing this site is because, one thing, we have objects on exhibit outside, and two, that we often get our cultural projects there funded. And my budget is my annual salary and $1,000. So any work that's done involving the collections has to come from special funds or project money. And basically there are two primary ways that I can get project money. And the first is to submit a project statement for a cultural project into the pot with other park projects. And it's the park management team that goes through and selects the projects and prioritizes them. And unfortunately, most of my project statements do not rate into the top 20, which means they really don't get any funding. So the second way I can get funding is to use what they call in the Park Service the checklist for preservation and protection of museum collections, which every park in the National Park Service fills out at least once a year. And what they do then is they list all your deficiencies, and which is, you know, kind of humbling at the same time as important, so I don't mind doing it. But what happens then is this deficiency list goes to staff in our regional offices, and they're the ones who then select a project that may either deal with just one individual park in one of their projects, or it can deal with several parks that have the same deficiencies, so each park receives the benefits of that project. And that's the way that we've been able to get archival cataloging done, IPM plans done, and conservation surveys done. And I know it's always a fight to get funding no matter where you are. And I've found that it's important for me to have complete proposals ready just in case park money turns up or other funds become available. And I also need to work with others in our divisions because I found that if you address your needs and theirs in one project, you have a higher chance of getting that project funded. And it works really well with small projects and purchases. And if another department will pay for my stuff, I'll let them. I don't mind at all. So let's see, where'd that go? We're going to start the slides talking about gates and fences in the National Cemetery. And this iron gate is the entrance to the cemetery. And because all the gates and fences are part of the historic fabric of the cemetery, any time that they need repainted, repaired, or replaced, the process has to start with historic research and compliance. And this project here, it shows you where it, with its primary paint, was needed because someone drove their car into the gates. I'm not sure how they did that. They were trying to get in. Rushed to get into the cemetery, I guess. And you see these points on the fence, and just a few months ago, one actually fell off the fence and just missed a ranger's head. He wasn't very happy. And I have that spike in my collection now. That just shows you some more damage. We have a few monuments at the park. This GAR monument was added to the cemetery in 1882. And it was moved from the center of the cemetery here to its present-day site in 1956. And this is where it was after that. And after Katrina, it had to be taken completely apart, conserved, and reassembled. And the park actually had NPS Katrina funds for this project. But we found out that we should always be prepared for surprises because this is the time capsule that was put in the monument in 1956 when it was first moved. And supposedly it contains items that were in the original 1882 time capsule. But unfortunately, we don't know if that's true or not because it took 5 years for the staff to bring it to my office and let us know they found it. And now we need a conservator to remove the items, which means I'll get to do another project write-up. And those are just the cannon tubes on the monument. This is our spots marker, which you can see it's a stone-loving cup-shaped memorial, which was erected in 1890 to honor a veteran of the New Orleans campaign. And it stands all by itself in the southwest corner of the park. And it often gets neglected, unfortunately, because sometimes out of sight means out of mind. And we always have to make sure that we're catching everybody. All right, this is, I'm ahead of myself here. This is the Chalmette Monument. It took decades to build, starting in 1855. Its care fell to different agencies and groups until 1893, when custodianship of the monument was placed in the hands of the Louisiana Society of the United States Daughters of 1776 and 1812. It was under their management that it was completed in 1903. They eventually turned it over to the federal government in 1930. In this image, you can see some of the damage at the top. There's growth on the stones, and there's issues above the doors. In 2005, they were doing some repointing and growth removal work. And the funds they got were through facility management. And they did it as a one-time project, and it probably could be a cyclical funding source, which would be a good choice because this work has to be redone every several years. What's amazing is the scaffolding that you see was still standing after Katrina. All right, and we're going to talk about the Chalmette National Cemetery, which is part of our park. There are brick walls around its exterior, and after Katrina, this is what they look like. So luckily, once again, we did get some NPS Katrina money to contract for the work. And the specs they used were based on the original brick walls that were erected in 1873. And unfortunately, after that work, the walls were hit by a lightning strike, and we lost some more bricks. All right. You know, the conditions of the headstones is always an issue for the park. Keeping them straight and above ground is a challenge, and they are often darkened by emissions from area refineries and from tree excretions. And usually the marble wears away. Some headstones get broken or they get lichen growth. And sometimes the tree roots wreak havoc on the stones and their position. It takes a lot of manpower and time to keep up the cemetery. So to get seamless help from various volunteer groups, the park created a headstone cleaning plan. And this is AmeriCorps helping us out. And the Louisiana Green Corps. Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument has hosted two hands-on preservation experience crews called the Hope Crews, at which we are hoping to get work done this spring. Their first crew conducted preservation work on funerary features in Custer National Cemetery, and the second project focused on preservation of historic markers on the battlefield. And in the handout, I have information on AmeriCorps, the Green Corps, and Hope Crews. Now, without help from these volunteers, the cemetery suffers because right now we have a staff of 3 maintenance employees, and they have to care for not only the cemetery but the whole Chalmette Battlefield site. And there are close to 16,000 cemetery markers in the cemetery. So now that Katrina funds are gone, any major project for the cemetery requires finding other funds. Now here is a surprise. We ordered a headstone for this grave that was missing a stone. And when we dug down to put in the new stone, we found that stone was actually there under the ground. And we think it might have been done during Katrina, but it could have been done at any time. Now here's a worker from the National Center for Preservation Technology and Training straightening a headstone. NCPTT strives to develop and distribute skills and technology that enhance the preservation, conservation, and interpretation of prehistoric and historic resources throughout the United States. It conducts research and collaborates with partners on projects in several overlapping disciplinary areas, which are organized into 4 program areas: archaeology and collections, architecture and engineering, historic landscapes and materials conservation. And I put information on NCPTT in the handout. And this is just an example for you, so that you don't want to make more work for yourself. The crane used to remove some large tree limbs could not handle the job and fell over, which resulted in several chipped and broken stones. So make sure that your crane operators know what they're doing. And I'm going to talk a little bit about Canon 2 preservation and conservation. If you're lucky enough to get a volunteer who retired as an aerospace engineer and who is a blacksmith and knowledgeable about cannons, you've hit the jackpot. This, unfortunately, not at my park, but this is at Yorktown Battlefield. And Yorktown is only one of 2 cannon shops still operating in the National Park Service. And Fort Sumter National Monument partners with the Warren Lash Conservation Center at Clemson to conserve historic metals, and they get their funds through an Adopt a Cannon program. And this is a 2007 reproduction naval cannon on a wooden carriage. Within a year on the line, it needed conservation, and this carriage needed to be replaced. Typically, cannon lasts about 7 years on the battlefield before they need to be conserved or restored. In 2010, we got $120,000 project money to conserve all of our cannon tubes. But this is quite a rarity. It's been the only conservation project of this size since I've been in the park, which is over 20 years. And the cannon tube is so heavy that we needed a large crane to move it. And the crane operator was the father of the other crane operator, but the father knew what he was doing. So the conservator removed corrosion and on the tube and painted the tube. But unfortunately, the carriage had to be taken apart, repaired, painted, and reassembled, and that required additional money. So definitely plan for exigencies. The aluminum carriages on the line also are affected by the elements, and there's mold on the left-hand side, or my right-hand side, that has to be removed routinely. And we're lucky that the company who made these for us come back each year before the anniversary of the Battle of New Orleans and touch up the paint and make any repairs. And they do that on their own dime. So it's nice to have friends as you go along. And this tube I just added in here because it really doesn't fit our scope of collection statement, but we were lucky enough that the funds covered it so that we could also conserve this tube. Okay, this is actually a Columbiad tube. It's not a Brennan tube, in case there's any Canon experts out there. We have four of these in the cemetery, and not too long after I got here, I went and I painted the catalog number under the trunnion, basically where the arrow is. And the next day I came back to see how it dried, and it wasn't there. And that was when I found out that the Boy Scouts came annually to paint these tubes. So I was operating in ignorance. So you learn things as you go along. The National Park Service, we only use reproduction artillery in our black powder demonstrations. And a tube can be redlined if the vent hole is too big. And last year we found out that they were too big on five of our repro cannons. So we contracted the work out, and the company that did the work were able to devise this method of attaching the drill to the cannon tube and do the work in place instead of having to take the cannon tubes to their workplace, and it lowered their bid considerably. And the money for this came through our interpretation division because they're the ones who have the black powder program. And we do deal with some cultural landscapes. Fazonville was a historic African-American community that thrived from 1867 to 1964, right in the middle of the battle site. And now it's hardly detectable above ground. You can sort of see the trace of the road there. And we've had a lot of, conversations about the interpretation of this non-battle related feature. And it's proved problematic to the park's primary mission of interpreting the battle landscape. Yet we know the feature holds historical, cultural, and ethnographical significance in its own right. So at this point in time, we are trying to do more interpretation of this site. So I guess the points I've been trying to make, or I'm hoping I'm making, at least alluding to, is that I should have projects ready to go, including all facets, do your homework, make realistic cost estimates, and work with other divisions to obtain your goals. Safety and security issues make your projects go up to the top of the list, so if you can include those factors, please do. And know what others are doing so your efforts aren't duplicated. I think I've mentioned that. Find other avenues than money, and be friendly and make relationships. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Rowan Geiger. I'm the director and principal conservator for SF Art Conservation. We're a Bay Area company focused on objects conservation and sculpture in San Francisco. And about 75% of our work is public art and sculpture. We work with a number of museums, more than one public art collection, and a number of large and small collections. All public art and outdoor sculpture can be challenging as a conservator. Size, scale, and location are big issues. The outdoor environment takes its toll on permanently installed artworks. and the work can be physically demanding. Sometimes projects can be very complex, involving large numbers of experts, and California water shortages and tightening of rules over VOCs can all become issues. So I'd like to show you a few examples of work that we've undertaken in and around San Francisco and some of the challenges and some of the solutions. So this is to give you an idea of the range of pieces that we work on. This sculpture is Will by Mark DeSouvreau. At well over 50 feet, it was by far the largest piece we'd ever worked on. And hot-rolled steel surfaces are actually quite challenging because there's a lot of fragility to the mature steel surfaces. We often have to work at height on aerial pieces. This is a myelin piece, and it's at the California Academy of the Sciences. And if you can see on the right-hand side, we're actually working above the main cafe in the museum. And so there were certain constraints in terms of safety for the public. We could only hose at certain times and so on. Jen mentioned this piece. It's 77 artworks scattered through hiking trails in a park in San Francisco. And this created challenges in terms of how do we actually move water and all our equipment through the park from piece to piece. And we decided that backpacks weren't really going to work, so we utilized small carts and hand sprayers, and it actually worked quite well. But it was challenging, hiking as well as working. Sometimes the artworks are in very high traffic areas. This is just through security at San Francisco Airport. In Terminal 2, the Janet Eckelman nets are really, it's a high traffic area. There's a lot of dust, and the area is in use 24 hours a day. So all the work has to be done on scissor lifts at night from 12 and 4. Jen also talked a little bit about the domestic seating installation. This piece is what I call functional art. I see it as something quite distinct in that the art is intended to be in use by the public. And of course, it is in use 24 hours a day by people sitting on them, sleeping on them, all sorts of things happen. So, and with frequent interaction bring a lot of challenges to the art piece, and we've had back slats sawn out in addition to frequent tagging, and people love to sit on them with alcoholic drinks, and which takes off the patina despite protective coatings. And this chair on the right, you can see one of the back slats has actually been sawn out. This artwork is a silicon bronze. It has suffered extensively from environmental damage as well as the public interaction. And the artist applied a very light ferric nitrate patina to the surface. And the photo on the left shows you the day of installation, how golden the pieces were. And because of the environmental situation, we have not been able to maintain them at the same color. But our approach has been to have monthly maintenance, stockpiling of elements that are frequently stolen, like the backsplats. We've recently acquired the original molds for the chairs, just in case. And those have gone into storage, and we have ongoing testing. So one advantage of contemporary art is that knowing the foundry, we've been able to obtain original samples of the correct bronze and with the patina, and we have a series of tests going on with them to see if we can find a more successful solution. Since bronze is one of the most common materials in public art collections, it's helpful to understand a little bit more about what you're looking at. And when a bronze comes out of the foundry, it normally has an artist a patina applied, a chemical patina that's chosen by the artist and has a light wax coating applied in most cases. And then it goes into the outdoor environment. This piece, the yak, on the right-hand side, it shows the original patina. And I think that photography of artworks, as soon as they are installed, is really important because we do reference archive material all the time for looking at things, how pieces have changed. Over the first year of install, the wax will break down and spots of corrosion will form. And gradually, if it's left unmaintained, you'll end up with what you see on the left, which is a corroded bronze. And so I think it shows that maintaining those protective coatings is essential. This is the Korean Monument. It's in a downtown park in San Francisco. As you can see, it has a dark brown patina, which was tagged. And this would not have been a problem, but I think we heard about it on Friday. We couldn't get to it because we were already scheduled, and neither could any of the other companies in town. And we went back after the weekend on Monday morning to find that somebody had, a well-wisher, had tried to remove the tagging themselves and actually sanded off the patina. So time is of the essence, and having your conservation team lined up, ready to respond, is pretty important, but obviously things still happen. This is a set of figures by Magdalena Abakanovitz, and I think what's interesting about this is just shows how the variation of patinas that can be achieved across even a set of almost identical figures as such. There's a light, there's not only is there differences between the pieces, but there's variation on individual elements. And this piece has been outside since 1999, and it, because of regular careful maintenance, it's in perfect condition, and we've managed to retain the original look of this work. We maintain, as part of maintenance, we do monitoring, and we do that in a variety of ways. We use spreadsheets and also photo imaging programs where we date and update any damages, and you can see in the bottom corner there's a recent damage. And it gives you a very good sort of history of the piece, in a sense, and you can look at it at different points in the life and see what's happened to it. The Cliff Garten piece, since it was only installed this year, has been an ongoing problem with the rusting, and that's the team working on it over there. It requires a big team. We had to have two large booms, and we worked in collaboration with one of the fine arts companies to do this. And on the right is the sculpture after all the rust has been removed. But you can't... I think that working with conservators earlier on is a good idea, just in terms of for material science questions and building a maintenance plan. The Anamurk benches that were damaged by acid. This was quite interesting because we had actually a lot of issues with cleaning these pieces because you can't even get, there's not enough room between the rods to really get your hands in to do cleaning. So considerations like that and working with the artist to enable sort of adequate maintenance is also a good idea. This is another example of where time is of the essence. This piece, which the Fireman's Monument, had a large blue spray paint tag almost around the whole thing, the whole base. And the travertine stone is extremely porous. Again, we were all too busy to get to it straight away. And by the time we did, we had really quite a major job removing that blue paint. And the left-hand photo shows the after treatment. We did get there, but it was quite a job. Oh, and the other thing to say about that is that we do find that using sacrificial coatings on porous surfaces is quite helpful where the pieces are frequently vandalized. This is Conquest of Space. It's a large sculpture, steel with painted surface at SFO and it was located in a pond with fountains, and a few years ago it was due to be reinstalled outside the new international terminal. And I think the interesting thing about this piece is just the complexity of the team that you need to have in place to be able to deal with a project like this. So we had it had a lot of structural damages to the feet because of the water. The paint was completely chalked. It didn't look anything like the original artwork. And the fins were bent and other issues as well. So the team that we had to assemble in order to do this involved structural engineers to assess the rusting. We needed to have a wind study done to see whether these short welds could support the fins in what's actually quite a windy location. We needed a large metal shop to take out bends in the fins and do repairs to the feet, welding. We had original samples of the paint, and we actually sourced out a second set of samples to compare them to see whether changes had occurred over time, and then we developed the paint system from that. And we needed a industrial paint company to apply the coatings who would work with us and to our specifications, conservator for writing specs, registrar, rigging company, and crane company. So all in all, quite complex project. And then this is a piece also owned by the Arts Commission. It's a Ruth Asawa, and I think most people are more familiar with her wire sculptures, but in fact she did a lot of work using a sort of salt dough, and there's quite a few of these pieces around San Francisco installed. This is one that she did with a school, and it's the top two photographs show the piece as we saw it the first time. It's 16 feet long and 4 feet deep, but it had been split in half by the earthquake in 1989. And so earthquake zone, natural disasters, we occasionally have to deal with this. And it was also covered in a lot of layers of paint and sand because it was located next to a sand pit, and sand between the layers of paint. And once we did the research and discovered how the original surfaces should look, we started to unpack the paint layers and found this massive tag underneath all the paint layers. And so the Department of Public Works had basically been going over, just painting over the surface of the sculpture and the sand and everything. So it was, it had lost a lot of its sort of relief. And here we are unpacking those layers of paint down to the original surface, and that was it, installed with a brand new stainless steel framework to hold it together. And I think everybody, including the family, was very pleased with the results. So I think my conclusion about public art is that, you know, we often see the dark side of public art in that it gets damaged and vandalized and things. But from working out on the streets on the domestic seating chairs, the street installation, I think it's amazing how many people actually come up and thank us for the work and just say how much they love the artwork. And so I really do believe that public art does enrich people's lives despite the challenges.
Unfortunately, I think we're out of time for questions, but we did create a digital handout of resources for public work care and maintenance. So I believe those will be shared with all of the attendees. Thank you.